Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me today on the Class War Battlefield podcast. Please do me the honor of supporting this work that I am doing. I've been doing this work now for free on your behalf for, my God, 11 years. 5, 10, 20, 50. If you can afford it, please do. Cash at me at $CWB Podcast. CWB Podcast. Cash App it. CWB Podcast. Also, hit me up on PayPal. CWB Podcast. All the way across the board, y'all. Help me out. Thank you for donating and enjoy the show.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother Vimir Dis Ogaya, and welcome back to the Class War Battlefield podcast. Why are things so bad? I've been sitting by the sideline for quite some time, watching what is happening in this country. And as you all know, I last dropped an episode in 2021, and I did so even though I was quite sick at the time. Recently, I took another job which allowed me to have some downtime to rest. I was absolutely exhausted, and I didn't realize that. I didn't realize how exhausted, I should say, I was, until I really became entrenched in that downtime. It took about a month, a little bit over a month, between my last employment date and me really feeling the effects of exhaustion. Now, obviously, you know, if you've been listening to Class War Battlefield podcast for some time, you know I've talked about the exhaustion in this society, the tiredness in this society. I underestimated the exhaustion, the tiredness. In the black community, and those of you in the black community, you know this, there's this old saying, The elders used to say it. Some of us new ones still remember it, and we sure enough say it. I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. What does it mean to be sick and tired? We often don't think about that. What does it mean to be sick and tired? I used to think about being sick and tired as, you know, having a cold. And then being tired because of the cold. But that's not what that meant. What it meant was something far more insightful. To be sick and tired acknowledges that a being, a person, a soul, is infected with something that is larger than themselves. And it is through that infection that they have been brought into being tired. Now you may say, well, wait a minute, that's just, I mean, the flu is larger than one person, a cold is larger than one person. No, this is actually bigger than that, because it's not associative with viruses and bacterium. Amazon, in the weeks following Donald Trump's election, and I don't know if this was there, I have to imagine it was there before his election, but it was pushed harder after his election. Amazon began promoting packages of 10 digital book downloads. And in those packages were books that dealt with collective consciousness and the mass mind, the public mind, and the diseases therein. I actually picked up some of these books. I didn't pick up the packages because I don't have a Kindle, but I went out and I ordered some of those books. And as a person who was familiar already with the idea of collective consciousness, the public mind, the idea that there is this energy that moves, within the public mind. These books brought me into alignment with the idea that this perception of the public mind is underutilized in appreciating the cultural mechanisms which feed people and motivate people. In looking at a society as a body politic, that public mind, that mass consciousness is important, because it's that mass consciousness and the layers to that mass consciousness that separates what you might call high-level thinkers and what they might call low-level thinkers, people who are down where I grew up. Well, in ancient times, it was said that it was the attentiveness, the attention, and the willfulness of the people at the lower areas of society that gave power to those at the higher levels of society. And if that willfulness and attention was taken away, that is when the, quote, powerful became destabilized, because they didn't have that energy buoying them. If this is to be believed, I believe it is to be believed. I really do. I believe this is a fact that is often underappreciated, especially in Western civilization and Western societies. If it's to be believed, that means one person does as children and parents do to one another. A person pours themselves into a society. They pour themselves into the collective consciousness, the social stratas, the public mood of their society. And in doing so, they give relevance and power to institutions. They give relevance and power to institutions. And if there comes a time, because, look, I'll be very honest, institutions require that energy, require that pouring into. That's the concept of allegiance. Allegiance is the taking of some of your personal energy, some of your internal attention and will force, and giving it to those institutions, to that society, to build itself out. You are literally giving approval with your auric energies to build structures in your name. This is why a lot of Muslims and a lot of external people from the United States who are rooted in older traditions often blame the people who are at the lower levels for what their governments are doing. It is also why some of those people blame the folks at the higher levels. As one Muslim person once told me, the reality is overseas, they realize that Americans are being manipulated to some extent by the people up top. So there's a reflection that is not true when it comes to the actions of those who are at the top of the society being approved of by the people at the lower ends. Anyway, we give our energies to these institutions. But sometimes, and this tends to happen over an extended period of time, the institutions demand more and more and more of us. And in that institution's demands, we become, what's the word? Exhausted. We not only become exhausted because the institution is demanding more energy from us, but because this is a societal-wide demand, we become exhausted because people around us are demanding more energy from us. We are having to pour more into them to keep them going. That's when we become exhausted. And that is when that exhaustion turns into being sick and tired. We are afflicted. We are sickened by those institutions, which are then making us tired. To understand this even more, let's look at that lower stratum of society, which people often call poor, or the poors, P-O-O-R-S. It is interesting to me, and I first thought about this years ago, over a decade and a half ago. I pondered why, and I know there's some official explanation to this that goes back to another language, which is where the word poor started, and then it got translated into English, and blah, blah, blah. But I think there's a deeper reason for it. I question why was the word poor similar to the word poor? Now you just say, wait, same words. No, they're said similarly. But, they are not the same words. When you're talking about people who are without sustenance and money and comfortability in their finances, you're talking about people who are poor, P-O-O-R. When you're talking about dumping something slowly from a pitcher or from a bucket or, you know, dumping some liquid out, you're talking about pour, P-O-U-R, or pouring. Why were those two words similar? It took me about a decade to realize the reason why was because, again, people at the bottom of the society, on a materialistic level, they give out all of their monies. They give out all of the resources which they gain from employment and working because they have very little room for growth financially. But at the same time, on a more metaphysical level, they give their energies to making the society run. I thought it was an amazing coincidence. And man, to all the black preachers out there, man, ain't God good? Good. What did God do? God ripped the mask off of this society, didn't he? I thought it was absolutely a masterstroke play by the divine. Sorry if you don't believe. I do. It's what it is. Anyway, at the beginning of the pandemic, when everything shut down, there was nothing but praise for the average worker. You're our heroes. You're helping us go. You're helping this society grow. And you're helping them keep going. You're wonderful. You're awesome. We're only going to give you a little bit of money while we give the rest to Wall Street because, you know, hey, whatever. You're great. You're wonderful. Wait 1 year. I don't even know if it was 1 year. And then suddenly, you're lazy, you're disgusting, you're horrible. Why are you just the most treacherous beings in this country? You ever want to see what a narcissistic lover thinks about you? Let him believe that you ain't watching. In under 12 months, the poors went from being honorable heroes to lazy bums who don't want to work. And Lord forgive them if they want more money, because these companies who are more profitable than anything, you know, in the history of the world has ever been profitable, these companies don't want to pay them. Just recently we saw what happened with the railroad strikes, which I am just, I'm done with baby boomer and I'm done with a lot of the baby boomer politicians. I'm done with them. They're lost causes. Get off the stage. And I have deep concerns for Generation X and Y, who came after them. But I'll have to see what's up with that. Anyway, the poors literally pour themselves into the workings of this country. And this country, just like institutions in the past, have required them to constantly pour more and more and more and more and more of themselves in without anything resembling relief being offered in return so that they can replenish themselves. This is what continues this problem of being sick and tired. It literally took me about 3 months to really recover from being overtly exhausted. There were pains in my body which, if you had told me 10 years ago that I would have pains in those areas of my body that I did, I would have told you were insane. I was in great condition. I had had a little bit of time to relax, a little bit of time to really catch my breath, mainly because I was living in an area where employment, jobs, good jobs particularly, were hard to come by. Well, I worked at two, because I left one job for another job, but two labor-intensive jobs. The one didn't start off as horribly labor-intensive, and then it became labor-intensive. And I spent the better part of 5 years doing very, very labor-intensive jobs. But I spent the better part of the last 10 years doing very labor-intensive jobs. And it wore me down. It wore me down to the point where it was hard for me, even to some extent over the last year and a half, especially after I got sick and I didn't have time to properly recover. My mind became foggy. And I wasn't able to think at the levels that I had been able to think before. And that helped me to really see the deviousness in this system. The deviousness in this system. In the fact that there are literally tens of millions of people who believe that this is a natural state of existing in this country. And they argue to maintain this state of existence, even though it is killing them every day. Goes to show you how sick this society is. I've told y'all this before. I'm a huge Dr. King fan. And there's some time when I'm going to have to really come out and do an episode on black conservatism and slap down a lot of these notions of what black conservatism is and what Dr. King conservatism is, because I hear a lot of people talking about what I've talked about when it comes to Dr. King's conservatism. But very few people, one, they don't mention my name. Whatever. Bet you half of them don't even know I'm the one who gave it to them. But also, two, these people have no clue what kind of conservatism I was talking about. Black conservatism has always been different than white conservatism. But again, I'm going to have to come to that someday. Anyway, there are a treasure trove of Dr. King's speeches, which most people have never heard of. And there are sermons that he gave, which again, most people never heard of. And one of those speeches has to do with the tensions in life. And another one of those speeches has to do with the family, the crisis within the family unit. And both of them are beautiful, beautiful. Actually, I think both of them are sermons, technically. Both of them are beautiful because what they do is they try to contextualize the life, the living structure that is causing many of the problems within the individual and within the family. And it is both are very striking. We rarely talk in terms of those tensions anymore. We rarely talk in terms of the crises within family without attaching it to some dumb culture war that has little to do with actually fixing families today. I know I've been talking about periodically over the last like 7 years, about producing another podcast or rearranging this one. And for a while, I did actually start another podcast. You guys don't know about it because I didn't really talk about it. I started another podcast. I put out maybe 5 or 6 episodes. It became a little overwhelming because of the job that I was working, and I had to drop it, and I just kept doing this one. In the next 2 years, that podcast is coming. And I can promise that because I'm already starting to do work on it. My new job is going to allow me to have time to work on it, which is going to really make me happy because I'm going to get to do some of the stuff that I wanted to do on this podcast for a long time, but just didn't have the time nor the energy to do it. Recently, I'm going to kind of make a hard turn here, too, because I want to talk about something else, which, you know, kind of has a little bit to do with this, but it doesn't have a lot to do with this. So, anyway, recently, on one of the YouTube channels that I follow, documentary creator David Hoffman, he had posted a clip from a interview he had conducted. I don't know when the interview was. Probably in the 1980s. It kind of had that feel like it was from the 1980s. And he was talking to an author. And the author said something very, very interesting about the baby boomer generation. Something that has been lost between generations. Because the baby boomer generation, the most entitled generation, positively entitled. You have to look at what the word entitled means, by the way. It's not negative, as most people like to think of it. They're the most entitled generation that has existed in this country. And they were entitled thanks to the hard work of the same people that most of them turned against. Okay, maybe not most of them. I'm wrong for that. That's, yeah, no. The post-World War I generation turned against the people who helped to entitle the baby boomers. And then the baby boomers, in turn, turned against those people when they matured in the 70s and 80s. This man said that the hyper-individuality that emerged in the baby boomer generation didn't come about because it actually came about organically. Maybe I want to say it didn't come about inorganically. It came about organically. How so? He told this story, and I'm going to mess it up a little bit because it's not my story, but it is very instructive to understand how we got to where we're at. He told this story about a job, I believe, that he went to get. And when he entered that job, the manager was like, oh my God, come in, absolutely, yeah. So what can you do? Absolutely, yes, go, here, go to work, have fun, wonderful. Why? This man was from the baby boomer generation, if I remember correctly. What had happened was the previous generation wasn't that big of a generation. There was actually a deficit when it came to jobs in the United States. And I'm sorry, there was a surplus, not a deficit. There was a surplus of jobs in the United States. Meaning what? There were more jobs available than people who could work them. This is what made the Depression so great. Prior to the Great Depression, there was a massive surplus of jobs. And then the Great Depression hit, and wham, those fortunes turned quickly. And what was a surplus went to a drastic deficit. When World War II started, and technically before World War II started, that deficit started slowly going away. When World War II started, that deficit evaporated. Suddenly, there was more jobs than ever, and when World War II ended, that didn't stop. That didn't stop. So, when this person went to get their job, might have even been their father, apologetic, I should have probably got my ducks in a row before I told this story, but I really didn't know that I was going to be talking about it. Anyway, when they went to get a job, what happened? That surplus had returned. There was not enough people to work. Even with the doughboys coming back, and I love that word. You know, people often tell me, you got to be an old soul because you use all these old words that people aren't used to hearing. And doughboys is one of my favorite. Instead of, you know, calling them soldiers, what have you, doughboys. And it's, you got to look it up. The history of it is great. Anyway, so when they came home, there was still a surplus, even as they were integrated into the economy. There was still a massive surplus, which is, by the way, what made the idea of black people not being able to get jobs when there was such a surplus of jobs. However, though, I will say this, and this is the important part that he pointed out, that surplus only lasted for a brief moment in time. Then, as more and more people became integrated into the economy, people from Europe started coming to the United States and settling. People from other places started coming to the United States and settling. That surplus went away. Suddenly, you had to worry about standing out. And that mindset, which was evident throughout the late 50s, the mid to late 50s, of trying to stand out became even more ingrained as the 60s unfolded, and that surplus, which turned into a slight deficit, went into hyper-deficit mode. Suddenly, there were a lot more people who needed jobs than there were employers who needed employees. That impacted the baby boomer generation in a way that has not necessarily been properly calculated. The idea of hyper-individuality, the idea of networking so you can always remain employed, all of that came from this trend, this transition. And it changed how people thought about everything. Now, he didn't say that. He didn't have to. He didn't have to. It's evident to me when you go from a society that is begging you to come and work, to a society that is saying, we have too many people here. What makes you different from the other 50 people that are about to walk in here? You don't have time to look out for everybody else. Or at least, that's what you get in your mind. That's what you get in your mind. You are raised to think in terms of, I have to make it at the expense of all these other people making it. If I don't make it, that means I wasn't special enough to make it. There's a book that I remember coming across in Rick Perlstein's The Invisible Bridge book. And I'm literally searching my bookshelf for it right now. And I don't see it. The book is called Winning Through Intimidation, I believe. I can't see it right now. I just rearranged my bookshelf, so it's possible that I put it somewhere else. But I believe it's called Winning Through Intimidation. Think about what kind of society you have to live in to produce such a book. if there are not jobs for everybody, then the people who could be the most ruthless, the most selfish, the most cutthroat, those are the ones who are going to survive. Now, you may say, and I think it's an appropriate thing to say, well, this type of thinking has always been in the European Americans' culture. And I think that's a fair argument. But from the sounds of that interviewer, that author, it's possible that the Great Depression, World War II, and the resulting baby boomer generation not only magnified that thinking, but brought it out and imprinted it and encoded it onto the society in a way that completely overturned any communitarian ethos that was transplanting itself here. I'm not naive enough to think that, you know, the history of the United States doesn't suggest that that a communitarian ethos had a fighting chance over here, because let's be honest. Looking at FDR's second Bill of Rights, even with all of the things that I just talked about being true, the second Bill of Rights would have eliminated the need for that kind of thinking. And this society and this country chose another way. Now, as a black man, this is devastating because this is not how we think. And for many of the black folks who have adopted this way of thinking, look at what has happened to our society within the black community as we have adopted this way of thinking. There's an elder professor, retired now, named Dr. Obatashaka out of California, who has written two really stunning books on this idea of black people accepting what could be called an alien culture. This hyper-individualism, this hyper-competitiveness that is innate in the Euro-American cultural mind state, but was not innate in the Afro-American cultural mind state. Those two books, especially for black folks of a generation who's trying to understand what has happened between the generations, should be consulted. So, by the way, shouldn't a great book by Marimba Ani called Yorugu, Marimba Ani, y'all, Ani, A-N-I, Yorugu, Y-U-R-U-G-U. I just want to point out here, these three books that I'm giving right here, four, because I'm also going to recommend Civilization or Barbarism, for white people who are listening to this podcast, I thank you for, you know, listening, but I want to also let you know, these books are not to be taken lightly. Okay? Don't think that I'm giving safe books here. These are books that were written for black folks, written to explain what has been bedeviling us. They're not going to protect your feelings. Okay? So if you want to dive into these books, as we say, do your thing. But realize, I'm not giving them here to protect your feelings. These are books that are dealing with true information that is meant to explain something that we've been persistently living under. So, the two books that I would suggest that you get, outside of Ani's Yorugu, spelled out earlier, in civilization or barbarism. Dr. Obatashaka, O-B-A-T-S-H-A-K-A, O-B-A-T-S-H-A-K-A, first book, The Integration Trap, The Generation Gap. The Integration Trap, The Generation Gap. The Integration Trap, The Generation Gap. And the second book, which is actually, it came out before this book. Before this book. Obatashaka, again, Return to the African Mother, Principle of Male and Female Equality, Volume 1. Return to the African Mother, Principle of Male and Female Equality, Volume 1. Return to the African Mother, Principle of Male and Female Equality, Volume 1. If you'd like to support Dr. Obatashaka, who, you know, to be very upfront about, ladies and gentlemen, I am helping with some of his social media stuff, and that's how I was introduced to these books. If you want to really help him out, family, go to Gumroad, G-U-M-R-O-A-D, type in his name, Oba, O-B-A, Tishaka, T-S-H-A-K-A, and buy his books from there. The money goes directly to him. You know, he owns all of his own books. So help him out. So family, that does it for this episode. I don't know how often I'm going to be publishing, but I will tell you again that the new podcast will be coming. Questions, comments, concerns, you know you can always reach out to me. I am your brother, Vymir Diesel Gaia. Until the next one, y'all. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lives in the balance. There are people under fire. There are children in the camps. And there is blood on the wire. Thank you.